Hi, I'm Ray, and you're listening to Insert Quest Here. My pronouns are they, them, and she, her, and I'm coming to you from the unceded lands of the Awarbical and Warami people. Today, I have the wonderful pleasure of talking to Xavier Ho, a games researcher at Monash University, and the organizer of the Pride at Play gallery event. It's a pleasure to have you on the show, Xavier. Would you mind further introducing yourself to our listeners who might not be familiar with your work?
Hi, it's really wonderful to be here. So I'm a games researcher at Monash University, and yeah, also organized Pride at Play. I think it's more of an exhibition than a gallery, but we did situate ourselves in a gallery, which I'm happy to talk about why later in the show. And Pride at Play ran during Sydney World Pride in 2023, so that was like February, March, and then we ran it again in Melbourne in the city of Port Phillip in the town hall, and that was pretty much most of the June for 3 weeks. And yeah, I research queer games. I'm really, really interested in how games can be used as a storytelling medium, artful creation, self-expression, and just a way to tell stories that otherwise wouldn't have been heard. So it's wonderful to be here.
Yes, like I said, it's a pleasure to have you on. So Xavier and I met because I saw the call out for Pride at Play, and I signed up with my game Make Our Own Heaven, which is obviously that's a queer game because one, I wrote it, but also because there are some parallels to queer identity within Make Our Own Heaven. And so I submitted that, and I got to meet and talk with Xavier in the lead up to that, and it was really, I know it just as an indie game developer, it was really cool to have my work in an exhibition, especially when I don't normally self-describe as a games designer or a games maker, even though I am those things, but I most often self-describe as an artist. I'm not a visual artist, which is what most people in my industry hear when you say you're an artist, but I do think of what I do as art first, and everything else that it is second. So it was really cool for me to be in an exhibition, and it was really cool to be a part of that. Xavier, what first gave you the idea to put on Pride at Play?
Yeah, and I just want to say it was really awesome to play Make Our Own Heaven with you, actually, during the exhibition when we had an event running role-playing games. And so that also gave me a lot of insight curating these games and having to actually play it. It was very different from reading through the rule book and imagining how the game could be played. And also having that chat with you added another layer to understand the metaphors of the angels and the ideas of living in like this very space-oriented city that forces you to make certain decisions that involves very similar themes to what queer folks kind of go through. But coming back to your question, it was through conversations, man. Like, I feel like running exhibitions definitely is not in my blood, but I'm very, very interested to kind of put queer games in the public space as much as I can, because I do believe that when you think about playing games, people often think of Steam, often think of major things like PlayStation, Xbox, Switch, and what have you. And a lot of games on there are great, but they're often made by massive multinational teams that have a lot of things to think about. And because of that, they're made by a big team. Personal stories, personal struggles, and individual like lived experiences often get smoothed over. So we don't really see a lot of really good, deep representation of queerness in these games. And so I've always wanted to kind of shine more light and just give more space to queer game makers and artists like yourself. So that's one of the main motivators. But the idea really come from speaking to a whole bunch of people. And this, I can trace it back to when I had a Zoom call with the organizer of the Queer Games Bundle, Taylor McHugh, when they were really interested in trying to figure out how to make money, really, and figuring out how to make the Queer Games Bundle bigger. And I was also talking to Adrian Shaw, who's the co-founder, or founder really, of the LGBTQ Video Game Archive. She has a lot of people helping with her, but she's really the founder of that. And she's been documenting a lot of queer games all the way back in the late 70s, both digital and board games, all the way to modern day. So 2024 is the year we're talking about. And if you go to the archive website, that's also got games in 2023 and early 2024. And also speaking with my colleagues, right, like just trying to figure out how can we put queer games on the map? How can we put it out there? And one of the most obvious things was like, well, we can do an event. We can host a game jam. We can host a games exhibition. And then we just kind of have all these ideas. And it was just kind of really lucky that I think Sydney World Pride was coming to Australia because it's in Sydney. So there was a lot of interest in kind of having people flying into the country if they can afford it, as well as like, I guess, a bit of resource and money, especially when it comes to universities and institutions to be able to fund this kind of thing. And also when you coincide a exhibition with an event as big as Sydney World Pride, which had like 200,000 people, way beyond our level, right? We were able to say, hey, we want to run a queer related thing, but it's in games. And we think it would fit right in to the World Pride lineup. And once that pitch was accepted, it was so much easier to convince galleries and universities to give us some space and room to work together. And it's not a lot of money. We're talking about like, you know, $4,000 or $5,000 that would initially cover internships for students to help us design what the space could look like, and then just pay people and help us to figure out, you know, do we want web hosting? What does that look like? And eventually that money would then really help us push the project along. And really, like, Pride at Play wasn't like a major, like, it's not NGV or Acme, even though I would love to be at Acme. It was really much like a grassroots paying out of our own pockets to make it happen, that kind of thing.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think probably a lot of the I know for myself, I trying to pay for your to develop your own projects and things can be a bit of a struggle, and like you've got to balance what you think will help the project with like what you can actually do. I was so impressed with all of the work that everybody did for Pride at Play. Like you made a effectively like a catalog that was like a small book of all of the games with like a, I think it was a 2-page spread on each game in it. It might have only been 1 page, but still it was a lot of like information about the games. And you also made these little bookmark kind of informational leaflets for each game. So when you walked in to the exhibition at the like front desk, there were all these bookmarks of all the games that were featured in the exhibition, and you could pick up one to like remind you of the games that you saw there. And yeah, I loved all of the work you did, and obviously the physical presentation of the space. What was the process of getting games for the event? Was it, did you know which game, did you have an idea of the queer games you wanted to exhibit already, or did you get them through, most of them through like call outs and like requests for submissions, or what was that process like?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I'm thinking back, right? So coming back to that conversation piece, I started talking to Malian Butt, who's now at University of Melbourne. She's a games culture lecturer there now. But when I started working with her, she was still based at the University of Sydney. So the two of us kind of pulled together a team. And so that included Matt McKenzie, who is now both a game designer, and they're funded by Creative Victoria, as well as the co-director of Free Play, which is one of the most like longest running, I believe, independent games festival in Australia. And we also got Chloe Appleby, who's at the Powerhouse Museum in Sydney. And it's all connections, really. that we're just really fortunate to have. And so the four of us got together. I almost forgot. There's also Faye Daunt, sorry. Used to be a lecturer at SAE teaching games making, but now they've gone into making games full-time, which is amazing as well. So the five of us got together and we were trying to figure out, okay, so we know we won an exhibition because we got into Sydney World Pride, the pitch was successful, and we know we want to show it as like a long-running venue for 2 weeks where people can come in and go, and there won't be like, you know, too many condensed things, but we could have events to draw people in also. So what kind of games do we want to have in this space? And the conversation kind of got pretty involved. So if you don't mind, let me indulging a little bit to give you an insight of what kind of things we talked about. One of the things was we know we're going to be in a gallery space. So the space that we were offered for InKind, which was really nice, was at the University of Sydney. They have this student project gallery that was used to offered for PhD students that they were finished their PhD and they would like show off their artwork, and they have this space upstairs that's quite contemporary, and we got offered that space for 2 weeks. So we know it's a gallery space, it's situated at a University of Sydney. Generally, when you go to a university, going into a gallery is probably not on the top of your mind. You're not really thinking about, I'm going into a gallery space, I'm going to appreciate or interact with any of the objects there. And also when you're at a university, you have like a very different vibe compared to going to a big gallery like Acme. You're not really expecting to kind of sit there and interact and enjoy games, right? So we really wanted to make sure we can create a space that feels playful, it's interactive, it needs to have like a really cozy lounge room kind of a feel without being too formal. Like, we didn't want to make you feel like I'm walking into a gallery and I'm only allowed to look at objects but not play them. But at the same time, we still needed to kind of, I suppose, fit into the existing university gallery space. So it still needs to feel like a gallery, but it's one that has like chairs, lounges, sofas, computer desks that you can sit down and even play some role-playing games. So that kind of colored a lot of the game choices that we could choose. So we knew we wanted to cover both video games and tabletop games. And that was a very explicit decision we decided early on, because a lot of the games conventions, so I'm talking about PAX, that happens once a year in Australia and worldwide, as well as other sort of gaming events that it's very computer digital oriented. And in those venues, even though you do have a tabletop space, it's more like a play space. You don't really get to sit down and talk with the game designers or see trailers.
Yes, agreed.
With the exceptions, right?
Yeah, unless a game designer has a booth, and like for a game designer to get a booth at PAX is
so expensive,
out of most people's price range.
Can you remind me how much it costs? Because I think it's like $2,000 just to get like one side of the table.
I think it's definitely four digits. Which like
even I can't afford that.
Like three digits is out of the price range for most game designers, in Australia at least. Like, most tabletop game designers in particular. Like, if you told me, I think there was an event recently that I was going to go to. It's a pretty small convention, and they're like, "Oh, yeah, tables are like $100," and I'm like, "Look, that's reasonable, but also I'm not going to do that."
You're going to have to make the money back from sales, and that's a lot of money plus travel, plus insurance. Plus, yeah, that's a lot. Pro tip for those listening, I think if people want to get a table at PAX, probably one of the best ways is to group up, right? So join your community.
Like,
yeah.
And that idea like goes back to like Artist Alley stuff. So like often people trying to sell like prints and little craft goods and stuff at PAX or other large conventions, they will like do a group thing where it's like, oh, how many artists do I know? How many of us? And we'll just take shifts at the table throughout the weekend. And that brings the cost right down, like to the point where I have considered it for other events and things as well. But yes, definitely. Grouping up is a great way to try and lighten that burden. You were considering, you wanted to make a space that was both tabletop and digital games focused because of the fact that the tabletop stuff is often overlooked in the professional spaces here in Australia in particular.
Yeah, and that was something that we also was conscious about in terms of the space. So computer games are typically very noisy. There can be a lot of sound effects, screen flashing, whereas tabletop spaces kind of need to have conversations that take place. So in both the Sydney and eventually when we got a space in Melbourne as well, we made sure that the tabletop space is in a well-lit and also like not too distracting area, so people can sit down and feel like they've got a little private booth-ish kind of a space that they can sit and play. But really, the most important thing for us is to kind of figure out, say, when you tell someone, hey, you know, we've got a queer games exhibition, often they'll just ask, so what's a queer game? Like, what do you mean? And there's really no straight answer to that, right? It's a queer game. One way to think about it is like it's a game that features LGBTQIA+ and all the other things wonderful under the rainbow, their lived experiences and the things that really symbolizes some of the queer struggle, some of those, you know, feeling accepted, being validated, or even self-validation, and also finding like-minded people, finding people who are kind of in your own community, and many other stories that every individual has, and they're all unique, they're all very different. So thinking about what queer games can do in terms of telling these stories was very, very important for us. It's not just like, oh, we're going to feature a game that has a character who happens to be in whatever gender and sexuality orientation, but a game itself doesn't do anything to it. It's just you can play as this character. That's nice. Lots of games have tried to do that, and we appreciate having more and more better representation. That's getting better slowly. But for Pride I Play, we were really focused on games that are really telling stories that centers queer experiences. And if you were to remove these queer characters from the game wouldn't even exist. It just doesn't really make sense because you've removed the backbone of the symbology. You've removed the mechanics that was inspired by queer, you know, growing up, coming out, or even just finding love, or even explaining to people who you are, that kind of a thing. We wanted to make sure we focus on games like that. And because those games don't typically come out in the mainstream media, like I said before, it's just kind of getting smoothed over. That's why we had a particular focus on tabletop and digital games, like video games, right? That are in the indie market.
For sure. I think we might have moved past answering the actual question of how you recruited those games to the gallery. I think we kind of we had a really good you pointed out really well and illustrated really well there, like what kind of games you were looking for. But I'm wondering how you found those games to feature.
Yeah, sorry, I just kind of.
No.
Skip those questions.
You answered that fine. I think that was a great answer. I just was like, oh, hang on, we should probably actually answer the question.
Yeah, no, really good point. So we know that there is the Melbourne Queer Games Festival as well. And Luke Miller, who runs that, does a really wonderful job in pulling queer games together. So when we were looking at what Pride I Play can be, we didn't want to kind of be another festival. We didn't want to be an awards kind of a thing. It just wouldn't make sense to kind of overlap with what other folks are already doing. So callouts, as you might remember, when you saw the callouts, was one of the ways that we were able to have a better reach, I suppose, because, you know, the five of us can obviously email people, contact people, and we all have contacts to kind of say, hey, we really like the game. Can we curate it into Pride I Play? And I think that's kind of how a lot of the really amazing communities like Squiggly River in Brisbane and Serena Games in Sydney is doing, is they kind of are game makers that form those communities, and they all have friends who make games. So it's a lot easier for them, I suppose, to kind of have 7 or 10 games to be shown every 6 months or so. But for us, because we are curators, researchers, and games educators, we are not sort of in the same vein as we're not making games day to day. We needed a different way to reach out to game designers like yourself, right? So we decided rather than contacting people and doing this whole you-know-who-you-know kind of a thing, which is kind of parallels what a lot of the bigger institutions are doing. You kind of need to know the curator to get your work in. We didn't want to do that because that would inherently bias the curation by ways of excluding people who don't know us or the other way around. So we actually made that call out as our only way of, I suppose, getting to know people and then putting games on the list. And we might still kind of reach out to people and say, hey, you know, do you have any friends who are making this? But also, hey, we know so-and-so in Lumi Interactive, for example, they're making this game. We should kind of just email them and say, hey, we're doing this. Do you want to submit that kind of a thing? So we did email a couple of people to do that, to kind of have that bit of a snowballing. But we never commit to say we want to curate you. That's not what we do. We say, hey, we're putting on a queer games exhibition. We would really love to have as broad of a capture as possible in the Australia, New Zealand, and Southeast Asia regions. And since you're making this game already and we really love it, do you mind submitting to us so we can have a consideration? And we can't promise that it will be selected and stuff like that. So we were very careful when we do that kind of direct emailing. But otherwise, all of the games, and I would say 90% really, of the game starts on Pride I Play just came through via the form. We didn't really have initial contact with anybody in that way.
Wow, that's like, yeah, amazing. Yeah. That they all, almost all came from submissions via the call out forms. Like, I wouldn't have expected that from my own experience working like with games events and stuff. But I love that you made that sort of the you wanted to remove your own bias effectively by limiting it to only those submissions, which I think is admirable and also kind of cool. We've probably got enough time for like one more question, and so I wanted to get your Pride at Play. I feel was pretty successful. I enjoyed it. Everybody that I know that when looked at it thought that it was great. Obviously, you got to do it a second time as well down in Melbourne, and my understanding is that was also pretty well received. Do you reflect those sentiments, and also what do you think, where have you taken that, and where are you going from here? Do you think that you'll put on something like Pride at Play again, or do you have something else in mind for the future?
Yeah, I think that sounds like a two-part question, so I'll answer the first one first.
Yeah, let's go.
Do I reflect
how'd you feel?
Yeah.
Was it good?
I feel really good. So partly because, like you say, a lot of the games that came through, we've never really had any contact with the game developers, even though they're on our radar. It was really nice, actually, when I saw, for example, Logan's and also the one from Unpacking from Witch Beam. We were like, wow, like we couldn't believe we got those games, right? And also at the same time, when you sit in a gallery, like I was just sitting because I was working and also minding the gallery as well, people come through every, you know, 3-5 minutes on a busy day and every half an hour on a slow day. They will like ask you questions about, hey, what is this game and what are you doing and what is that? And you can kind of start to tell them about the whole purpose of the exhibition and what it's about. And you just get this like really wonderful faces, and I'm talking about like from uni students to like, wow, this exists, it's amazing, to like grandmas that I had one grandma who I remember this very well. I was sitting in the Port Phillip Town Hall when we ran Pride at Play in Melbourne, and the grandma just kind of walking and she's like, oh, what is this, and just kind of looked around and tell me that she's here to drop off her grandson because the town hall has these early education programs in the library across the road. And she's just waiting to pick up her grandson. So she thought she would come and wander around. And the gallery itself in St. Kilda, in Port Phillip, is like directly across from the reception. So it's very visible to everyone who walks in. And so we've had this like really wonderful conversations about her experiences, kind of trying to grapple with the language as it changed over time. And she was asking me, like, you know, oh, am I okay to say this? Can I want to say that word, that kind of a thing? And I have to tell her, like, you know, sometimes, yeah, sometimes you can use that. Depends on who says it and how it's said. And also, like, you know, maybe don't use this word. It's kind of out of date. And so I was also understanding that she had a very different life, and it gave me a lot of insights. And that was just like a really awesome conversation that I wouldn't otherwise have had. And this is just one of many, many of conversations that I've had when I was at a gallery. It's truly wonderful.
It feels like that experience might have even been transformative for both parties. Like, sort of the sharing of language is a thing that I have recently become quite enamored with. And I wish I was... I knew more about language, so I could write a game about language, but instead I would just have to include language as a secondary theme of my work. So what do you feel about the second part of that question? What do you feel like Pride at Play might transform into, or what are your plans for the future in this regard?
Yeah, so I'm pretty ambitious. I'm just going to say here, I would like to take Pride at Play and its future iterations to really big galleries like the Powerhouse, Sydney, and Acme. That would be my dream. So let's see how this pans out in the next 5 years, right? And this is partly because when you get sort of like that top-down recognition, you suddenly open up a lot of opportunities, not just for yourself, but also for the game designers that are featured in there. Like, you could have your game being archived into the Acme Games Collection or into the NFSA, the National Collection, that will be lasting for 100 years. But also you get just a much, much broader reach than the four or five of us that could ever dream of, right? Like, you wouldn't go to Sydney Uni, you wouldn't walk into Monash just to find games and play them. That's not what universities are normally about. We're here to educate, to broaden people's critical thinking, and hopefully pass on skill sets to the next generation. But you wouldn't come to university to kind of find out, hey, what kind of games are there? So because I work at a university and I am still a researcher, I'm very interested to, you know, obviously understanding what queer games can do and the powers of storytelling. But really, it is the cultural institutions like the galleries, the libraries, that have that public reach that we don't have. So I'm really keen to take it up the next level and just keep it free forever if we can. I don't think we'll ever make a paid exhibition, I'll say that too, because that doesn't make any sense. And also just try to broaden the kind of games that we can make, we can curate as well. And what I mean by that is, like, in the last 5 or 6 years, there's kind of like this cozy games, couch co-op games genre that's getting more and more popular, partly thanks to the Switch and partly thanks to mobile games, that people are realizing maybe, you know, Match 3 is not the only way to make games, but you can actually have really amazing stories that you can kind of live out by taking care of gardens and kind of looking through fishing, that kind of a thing, with friends, right? You can be social as well. So trying to think about where queerness and also other kinds of forms of marginalization, and I'm talking about like different kinds of economic opportunities and even cultural language barriers is another one, where that features in games, I'm really, really interested to find that. And hopefully broaden the idea of queerness. It's not just for queerness sake, but it's like, it's really complex. There's all kinds of individual experiences that would not otherwise come out if you only focus queerness through the lenses of queerness. So thinking about where queerness intersects with language, with culture, with feminism, and with all kinds of other forms of play and social is really important. And I think that kind of scope is so broad that I would just keep making exhibitions. It's gonna be a long game. I'm not saying I will cover that, or we will cover that in the next iteration. But we will try to be broadening and broadening while still staying true of giving voices to indie games.
Yeah, I mean, perfect answer. I feel honestly, it has been a pleasure chatting to you today, Xavier. And if you enjoyed listening to this interview, definitely go and check out our other ones. And on the in the podcast feed. Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Where, if people want to find out more about you and more about Pride at Play, where can they do that online?
Yeah, so Pride at Play has a website, and we're on socials as well, on Twitter and Instagram. It's not very active now that the exhibition is over, but you can still sign up for mailing list updates, and when we have the next iteration, we'll definitely put something out through that mailing list. So that's a really good way to make sure you will get something in your inbox without having to check all the time. And also, if you're more interested in my work more broadly, so I also do installations and projection artwork, and I also write as an academic. So I have a website, I'm on Twitter, X thingy. I just organized my Blue Sky account. I'm not sure how I feel about that. I think I'll just use it as like a, you know, once every month I'll post something. So we'll see. I'm pretty easy to find.
Yeah, and we'll have links to a bunch of that down below, as well as links to our own socials as well. As I said, it's been a pleasure talking to you today, Xavier, and I hope that everybody enjoyed listening to this. Farewell from the past. I'm Ray.